Succession number 9826, Reel 3.
Mr. O'Brien, Reel 3.
So the Germans at the same time were improving the quality of their aircraft, and it was a leapfrog situation which was continually going on. There was undoubtedly a fact that the Spitfire could outturn its opponents, but on the power basis that wasn't always so. So eventually, at the end of May, having done a number of convoy patrols and accumulated a few hours of active service, we were posted to Kenly. Kenly was a subsidiary of Biggin Hill. We settled in there on the 4th of June 1941 and started normal patrols, that is, Beachy Head to Shoreham. This was standing early morning patrols. This went on for two or three days, and then on the morning of the 8th of June we had a briefing that we were going on a sweep over France. We were to escort a dozen Boston bombers and a wing with Paddy Finucane leading would be fighter escort. The main purpose of the infiltration was to try and tempt the Germans up to have some combat. By that time, we had sufficient aircraft to go on the attack. For three or four weeks prior to this particular sweep, there had been no reaction whatsoever over northern France. Our particular squadron was flying low cover. We were probably at about 17,000 feet. The intermediate escort to the Bostons was about 18,000 feet, and high cover was at 19,000 feet. As far as I recollect, there was in all probability something like 90-odd escort aircraft to this squadron of bombers. We flew over towards Saint-Omer in northern France, and as we flew over Saint-Omer we could see the fighters coming up. Now I was flying what was called Tail Arse Charlie, that is, I was flying at the back and my job was to weave to make sure that the squadron wasn't being attacked from the rear. But if we went into combat, we broke off as pairs, the first of the pairs being the one to do the shooting and the second of the pairs to guard the tail of the one doing the shooting, which was a fine theory at the time. And I was flying behind Pilot Officer Fels, F-E-R-C, who's a Polish pilot. And as these fighters came up towards us, the Focke-Wulf 190s, my number one, Pilot Officer, peeled off to go into attack. We dived down onto the enemy aircraft, and I distinctly recall the feeling of seeing tracer bullet flying around in anger around you for the first time. We dived into this pack of Focke-Wulf, and Pilot Officer Fels attacked an aircraft whilst I was covering his tail. And during one of the moments when I was looking rearwards, he must have pulled out of his attack, because momentarily, as I looked forward, he was climbing fast away. And being inexperienced, I was trying to still guard his tail, so put on full throttle to climb up after him, and left my own tail exposed, during which time a fox wolf must have got underneath me. And the next thing I knew was that the petrol tanks, which were in front of you in the Spitfire, shot up in flames, and the aircraft became totally unmanageable, so that there was only one thing to do, and that was to get out, undo your harness, theoretically turn your aircraft over and drop out and get away from this burning inferno. From what I understand afterwards, I don't recall, certainly don't recall turning the aircraft over, but I remember getting out of the aircraft, being ejected out of the aircraft, and as I understand it, either the aircraft that had attacked me hit my tail and chopped it off, or he shot it off. I think the fact that another aircraft went down at the same time as me would indicate that it was more than likely a mid-air collision, because the whole of the tail went. And because of that, the nose of the aircraft plummeted forward, and having already undone the harness holding me into the cockpit, I was virtually ejected out of the aircraft, thrown out of the aircraft. I then recall tumbling through the air and realizing I'd got to pull the parachute ripcord. And bearing in mind that we didn't have parachute training in those days, that you were told that if you had to, you pull the ripcord, and that was that. So I pulled the ripcord and the wire came loose, and I pulled it again and again, and had a feeling that the chute wasn't opening, when suddenly I was brought up with a tremendous jerk and watched my right hand flying boot continuing on down towards the earth. So I looked up, and this parachute was perfectly deployed and open. So I started drifting down. I drifted down through the clouds, and when I say clouds, I suppose it was about 2/10 that you've got the odd cotton wool cloud. Excuse me. You had the odd cotton wool cloud, and one likes to think that one was steering the parachute through the clouds and getting cover, but in point of fact, you were at the mercy of the wind and you were drifting down. And this sort of suspended animation feeling was there. What's going to happen? What do I do? How do I land? What's down below? All of these thoughts flash through your mind, and eventually you get lower and lower, and you get the feeling that the ground is speeding up towards you, and at the last moment it really does accelerate. And I was very concerned at that particular moment in time, because as I became nearer to Earth I could see some electric wires, and I was very much afraid that I was going to hit them. And in the classical fashion, one is told to pull on one side of the ripcords to steer the aircraft. I was tugging at these cords, but whether I was having any effect or not, I don't know. But eventually I landed in this field near to a village. It subsequently transpired the village was called Steenbeck, Steenbecque. I had barely landed, and we were always told that as soon as you land, that you must roll up your parachute, try and bury it, and then try to get into hiding. So I was rolling up the parachute, and I noticed that my white polo neck sweater, which pilots of that day, particularly Spitfire pilots, were all prone to wear, with the silk scarf in the Biggles type of fashion. And I noticed this was sort of falling off in charred lumps. I looked at my hands and I found they were burnt on the wrists, and the face felt a little bit raw. before I'd even hidden the parachute in a ditch, an old lady came running up, and quite a few farmhands and people like this. And at that particular time, I didn't speak French. And one of these dear old ladies, or I suppose I say dear old ladies now because I've seen them recently, but she'd probably be about 40 years old at the time. She put a bottle of beer and a loaf of bread into my hand and said, "Allez," gave the signs to go and run. So, in the meantime, more people congregated, and a young French lad walked up to me, and spoke to me in English. His name was Georges Lemaitre, L-E-M-E-T-T-R-E. So he tried to shoo all the people away, and he indicated to me that, or told me, to go into a copse, which was about a half a mile away, and hide in there, and all being well, he would come back at night and try and help me. So that I had completed hiding the May West and the other elements of flying apparel, helmet, in the ditch and covering it over with soil, and headed for this little copse. Having got into the copse, I sort of buried myself in leaves and covered myself over with leaves and lay down there and stayed there until it got dark.
What time approximately had you been shut down?
I was shut down about 12:30 a.m. or p.m. at lunchtime. So that I was there probably for, and this was, as we say, June the 8th, it was almost the height of summer. So I was there until something like 11 o'clock when it was dark. And I suddenly heard footsteps in the copse and a voice whistling something which was obviously some French air. And the problem then was this a ploy of German searching, or was it this young fellow that I'd met for 5 minutes? But it was a question of taking a chance, so I sort of got out of the leaves, and there was George. He said, "Quiet." And we started walking along the roads, hiding in ditches when we saw German patrols, and circumnavigated this village until we came to a brick wall of a property on the edge of the village. He told me to climb over. We climbed over, and over the other side there was a chicken coop, a brick-built chicken coop, and he told me to hide in there. And I found there was a deck chair in there, so I sat in the deck chair. He said, "Wait there, somebody will see you in the morning." So the following morning, a young girl appeared at the chicken coop. She lived in this house. Her name was Yvonne Dillies, D-I-L-L-I-E-S. So she brought me some food and some ointment. I was bathing my eyes and I couldn't see very well, and she appeared to be quite concerned.
Were you in much pain?
Not that I can recall. Discomfort, but not pain as such. And I stayed there for 2 or 3 days, and then on the third day, George came back. No, Yvonne came down and told me that I would have to go because the Germans were still searching, and there was a German officer billeted in the house, which was at the end of the garden where the chicken coop was. That he was a stupid German, but nevertheless it was getting very dangerous and she'd been interrogated, and that I would have to go. And she'd found a lady who got a farm at Haverskirk, which was H-E-V-E-R-S-K-E-Q-U-E, which was a village some 2 or 3 miles away, and I was escorted by George over to this farm. And there the lady was very concerned about my state of health, but the husband wasn't at all keen that I should be there, principally because he'd got 3 children and he was concerned that if the Germans came and found me there they would take reprisals on the family, which was understandable. So we agreed that I would go and hide in the bushes quarter of a mile from the farmhouse, and the mother sent some food over at lunchtime, and then in the evening she sent one of the sons to bring me in, and she allowed me to sleep in the house overnight against the wishes of the husband, and she said somebody is coming to fetch you tomorrow, or indicated. It is surprising that when you don't speak a language, how sign language can help you to understand what somebody else is saying. At the same time, she looked at the state of my clothes. I was still wearing these semi-burnt trousers and pullover. And she insisted on giving me a suit of her son. Her son was about 14, 15 years old, and the suit was about 3 times too small, but nevertheless it was civilian garb. But then, of course, the problem crosses your mind: if I become a civilian, do I become a spy? But you keep your dog tags, this is the identification disc that you used to wear, and hope to goodness that it's going to be right. Because you know that you can't walk around with an RAF uniform on, particularly in a burnt state than it was. So that I accepted this suit and a pair of moccasins, and went back to my hiding place the following morning. Towards evening, a girl appeared. Her name was Marcel Caron, C-A-R-N, and she brought with her a spare bicycle. And she had a few words of English. And she told me that I was to follow her at a safe distance. So that we rode along the side of a canal and through various back lanes, until we came through to the outskirts of a town called Aire-sur-la-Lys, AIRE-SUR-LA-LYS. There, I was horrified to see there were German guards, because it was the sort of town which is very enclosed, had probably 4 principal main roads into the town, and was fairly easy to keep under guard. So I saw these German guards on the edge, and it should be stated that because of the burns on my face, which were now going rather black and encrusted, that they had dreamt up the idea of putting some face powder on to try and cover the significance of it. Because the type of burns, when you have a flying helmet on, give away the occupation of the individual insofar as it is a circular burn around the eyes, nose, mouth, the part which is covered normally by an oxygen mask. And obviously when a plane goes up in flame, the oxygen mask is one of the worst things, because the burning is more intense in that area. So, willy-nilly, she cycled on past, and I turned my head away and passed the guards, and we rode into this town, right into the centre of it, past the market square, and she stopped outside a butcher's shop. Well, it was a butcher's delicatessen shop. She put her bicycle into the door opened, and she put her bicycle into the corridor, and signaled me to come in quickly. So I did the same, and her mother and father were there, and they pushed me up into the attic, and there I stayed. It subsequently transpired that they had been very, very clever, because bang opposite this butcher's shop was the headquarters of the General German Staff. It was in the Hotel de l'Angleterre, which the Frenchman found very, very funny, that the English hotel and the Englishman here and the Germans occupying the German hotel. So I stayed there for something like 3 weeks, and during that period they got hold of a doctor who had been a prisoner of war in the 1914-18 war and was very anti-German, and he came and treated the burns. I maintain to this day that he pasted them with glue for a matter of 2 weeks and then chipped off the incrustations with a knife at the end of the period of time, and I'm sure it wasn't much more sophisticated than that. This was just one of those things. Now, during this period of time, Marcel Caron, the daughter of the Monsieur and Madame Caron who were looking after me, she had a boyfriend whose name was Albert Nestark. Now, he was a Belgian by nationality and appeared to be able to commute between Brussels and France with some ease. After getting to know him a little bit, and once the burns started to disappear, he asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, well, get back to England. So he said, had I got any ideas how to do it? So I said, yes, I had. He said, well, what were they? So I said, well, I have a possible contact where I might get some help. I said, I'm afraid I can't tell you anything more at the moment, because we had been advised that to be very careful what information you gave when you were shot down, because you weren't quite sure who was who. Now, I had total confidence in everybody else that helped me up to that moment, but this character who was wandering in and out, Albert, I wasn't 100% sure, particularly as our conversation was in German. It was a fact that at school I had learnt German rather than French, which was at that time the principal language taught in the English school. And Albert spoke German quite fluently, so that with my schoolboy German we were able to have conversations. But the mere fact that we were talking in German raised a sort of question in one's mind. Anyway, before one left on a flight over enemy territory, one went through a briefing, and in the briefing at that particular period of time in 1941, you were told one or two addresses of safe houses in the areas that you should be flying over, and that you could expect to get some help from these safe houses. You were also equipped with 2,000 francs in money, which in those days was probably worth about £10, and an escape kit, which was a silk map, a little compass, iron rations, that sort of thing. So after a couple of weeks, I said to Albert, okay, we'll have a go, we've got to head south. He said, where to? I said, well, we've got to go down to the Toulouse region. Now, Toulouse was probably 800 kilometres from where we were. but the only address that I could remember was a safe house at a village called Negripelisse, N-E-G-R-I-P-E-L-I-S-S-E, which was some 10 miles outside of a town called Montauban, M-O-N-T-A-U-B-A-N. Now, it wasn't near Toulouse, or not within significant distance, but I was only giving him a general indication of the direction we were going, rather than any specific indications. So after 3 weeks, my health was in reasonable state by then. I felt the burns were very obvious, or the burn scars were very obvious. But nevertheless, it was necessary to do something. I suppose it would have been the first week in July. That one fine morning we got up early, Albert was there, and he said, we'll go by train on the first leg, we can go to Paris where I have a contact where we can sleep the night. So with a little suitcase, fairly well provisioned from this butcher's delicatessen shop, even in the times of austerity there, we went to the local station, boarded a train, and made our way to Paris. At Amiens, we had to change trains. There we had a little bit of a problem that a character who looked as if he was Gestapo stopped us and wanted to know the contents of the case. And when it was open and he saw the food, he took half of it and let us go. To this day, we don't know whether it was a con or whether it was a Gestapo man improving his rations. We eventually arrived at the Gare du Nord in Paris, and as we got off the train, we saw an inspection of papers taking place at the end of the platform. And though Albert had provided me with an identity card which showed me to be a deaf and dumb Polish worker, the idea being that I couldn't speak and I couldn't understand, nevertheless, I was afraid that it was going to cause problems. So that eventually we joined the queue going past the guards who were examining the papers. And as Albert produced his papers in front of the guards, I walked round the back of the guards and joined the queue beyond. And we got away with it. We then took a local metro out to an area called Saint-Denis, and there we made contact with this character who was dressed as a clergyman, and I found out afterwards to be in the sect of the Orders of the Knights of St. George, or something of that nature. We slept overnight there, then went back into Paris and caught a train heading towards Tours. Now, Tours at that period of time was a town on the demarcation line, because in 1941 there was still Vichy France.